Welcome back to the Sports Influence Podcast. Today's podcast is a little bit different. We're not focused on the all-star athletes or the trailblazers. We're focusing on the people behind the scenes, those people that train day in, day out to support the all-stars and get them to where they are. Today on the podcast, we've got Joey Akris and Ollie Olby. Both Joey and Ollie rode since they were children and rode at Durham University and competed at Henley. Despite this, they didn't quite make it to the top. Some would call them just great athletes. The athletes at the top, we'll call them maybe mediocre. But we're going to tap into this and see what drives them and what keeps them motivated. Let's get into the pod. Mediocre athletes. Where did it all go wrong?
Who wants to take that? Orby, do you want to take it or shall I?
I'm very happy to take that one. I've got a long list of ailments. it never really went better than mediocre, to be honest with you. Didn't really go wrong. I was, you know, rowing. That was basically the main sport. When I was younger, I played a lot of cricket. But that's obviously not high octane. Did a lot of rowing. And then in first year, I broke my wrist. Basically put me out for, I don't know, 2 years. It was pretty severe. And then, kind of never got the momentum back on being actually quite good at rowing. Arguably.
Yeah, I remember you were quite good. You were pushing for Henley, pushing for the first boat. And then, yeah, nasty injury. Nothing you can do about it. But it did make you a mediocre athlete.
So was that while you were at uni, you hurt your wrist then?
Yeah. I broke it just before summer in first year.
Right. Okay. And did you row from young?
Yeah, I've been rowing. I rowed at school. I was fortunate enough to row at school. So I've been rowing since like year 9. I don't know how long that is in years. 10, 11, 12. 6, 7 years. But yeah, I broke my wrist falling over in a car park trying to race Pearson to get shotgun in this car. Because we had this mate, Jake Lane. He had this car. It was like Audi, whatever. And obviously rowing, all of us are like 6'4" plus, right? So if you're sitting in the back of this car, you're cramped. So the shotgun was like a serious commodity. Anyway, yeah.
Fell over. Life or death.
Buggered the wrist. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's probably slightly different to Olby, to be honest. I think it wasn't like mediocrity forced through injury. It was more firstly at birth. Realizing a pretty severe lack of genetic strength and talent. And then secondly, at probably around the age of 14, when I chose to do rowing, and realizing that I was probably trying to fit like a square peg into a round hole, and that my body and physiology was not made for rowing, but I was going to do it anyway. So different ones. I feel like one's forced mediocrity and the other one's just natural. But yeah, that's what I'd say. So I guess similar to Olby, I started rowing probably around a similar time, to be fair. I think I was about 14 or 15 when I at least started doing it properly, and then carried it on through university and carried on my mediocrity through there.
Yeah, I was going to say, what kept you going through uni? Like, because you were like a mediocre athlete. You were in the rowing squad at Durham, right?
Yeah.
And you were obviously pushing for the first, but you wanted to get in there so bad. For me, when I was there, I was, you know, barely the third boat for quite a long time. But you were like that your whole life. I'm joking. You were like that for a good 2 or 3 years.
Oh, sure. That's rude.
No, you were pushing for that first boat for like 2, 3, 4 years. What kept you going through that time?
I mean, to be fair, I think it wasn't necessarily a case of trying to push for the first eight the entire time. I kind of feel like I had sort of intermediate goals along the way throughout those various set of years, and they were probably based on where I was before that point. So when coming to uni, my only goal really was to like make the squad. That was the goal, from where I knew I was at school to where I knew the sort of Durham rowing squad would be. So that was like goal number one. And then it was just a case of kind of moving goalposts, but those goalposts never really got like all the way up to GB first team or whatever. So I don't think it was ever really a case of like, why am I still doing this if I'm not making the first eight? Because those goals were kind of like fairly sequential, and they also were, you know, make the squad, then make strokes here to the third eight, then make the second eight, then make strokes here to the second eight kind of thing, and then go to Henley and win box medals and those kind of things. So I think they just kind of went step by step, and I was never thinking like, I need to be the absolute best in the squad or in the sport, because of, as I've sort of said before, the level at which I was starting was fairly low. So for me, that those goals were already an achievement, as opposed to like wanting to really strive for the first eight, which you might have done, Joel, given the fact that you had like a lot of sporting success in a different sport. You probably came in thinking, I want to be the best at this new sport as well. And maybe it would be more frustrating for you not being in that, you know, top boat straight away because of the success that you probably would have been used to in swimming. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I completely see that. It was definitely frustrating for me because I had the fitness, and as you know, on the erg, I was on the rowing machine. I was decent, but it just doesn't transfer onto the water. Like, you just need such a long time rowing, like at least 3 or 4 years, to be able to actually transfer any of the power on the rowing machine onto the erg.
Did you ever wear like a uni suit, or were you shorts and t-shirt the whole way through?
Yeah, there's a joke. There was a joke going around at Durham. Joe, I'll let Joey tell you about this.
Yeah, yeah. We've actually told lots of people about this because it's just funny. Even just, you know, people we meet on a random pub trip or night out or something like that. As a bit of a flex, but we always say that Joel has the world record for 2K pulled in cricket shorts. I think it was 6:03 on the 2K for on the indoor rowing machine. Is that right, Joel? 6:03?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And he did it in his Repton cricket shorts. Whilst everyone else was in their Durham first eight or second eight, like uni suits. He smoked. Yeah,
that's the most Joel thing, because even when we were swimming, it was the same. He'd just turn up and he'd be on like the watt bike or something in the gym in the most random clothes, but he'd still just be pumping it out.
Yeah. That's the thing. You can't make fun of it too much because ultimately he's just probably beating everyone anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But yeah, I remember Joel then used to give it a bit back as well to some of the other lads who were obviously had all the gear and like all the rowing kit stuff. There's another lad, Jude, who's from around the same area as you guys, I think. I remember Joel used to come up to him when he was rowing a session. He was like, "Jude, mate, why are you wearing hot pants? What's going on here?" And he would just try and give it a bit back, which I always thought was quite funny.
Albie, this one for you. Did you think you enjoyed like uni more, having less pressure because of your wrist, and just kind of taking it more chill? Chill. You, I don't know if it was chill, but not having that same pressure in the foot. Like for example, just being in the first boat, like you had more of a rising back to where you were kind of thing. Or did you feel more pressure?
I think it was more endless disappointment. The wrist was quite an ordeal. I really screwed up the recovery on it, so kept rowing with my cast on and all this kind of stuff. And then the big one for me was that I was probably my better suit was in sculling, and in sculling you have to do this with your wrist, and this is my broken wrist and it won't move more than that. So it really kind of hampered that ability, and I had to swap sides. So to be honest, it was kind of a endless kind of pain, and I had to sit on the bike in the back of the erg room when everyone else was doing their 30s and whatever, and just like gagging to get back. But obviously you can't, because you just break it more. So to be honest, it was just disappointment, and I think it would have been fine if I wasn't living with two other rowers, but the fact that I was living with two other rowers, it was just like, it wasn't miserable. I made my own fun, but it wasn't where you wanted it to be.
Yeah. How did you feel like in the rowing clique? Like, did you feel like you had especially like good fun? Like, obviously rowers, we have such a intense training schedule. Like most nights of the week, you might have different nights, especially at uni, where you can go out, like out to the club or whatever. How did you feel? Like, do you feel like there was a big rowing clique? It was just rowers like staying together all the time. Yeah, because obviously you live with rowers, you train with rowers. Being a having that broken wrist, you think it allowed you to just like spend less time basically with rowers and be able to like see other sides, play a bit of cricket, play a bit of football? Because I know, Joey, you played a bit of football for your college team at uni. You're a little sharp little player. Joey and I play a bit of five-a-side at the moment, and we hold the centre-back positions, hold the line.
I was going to say, Joel, there's no position apart from centre-back for you, mate. charge at the strikers.
Yeah. Because you did play cricket at uni, didn't you?
No, I didn't play in uni. I play like very casually. So there's a tournament called Last Man Stands, which is like 8-a-side cricket. It's basically like 5-a-side football for cricket. We play every Thursday evening. We've actually got a last game of the season like tomorrow or whatever Thursday is, 2 days. And it's just a bit of a laugh and you go to the pub after. It's like not very serious, but you know, it's great fun. So I did that a bit at uni in the summers, but I haven't played that much.
Yeah, you've been playing. Yeah, you've been getting into golf as well, haven't you? Because I know I saw a little video from your socials. Tell us about your Croclete little side hustle.
Little side hustle. Me and my mate, we were trying to work out like if we could actually do something impressive. And so our idea started was like, what's the the craziest mountain that we could hike up in Crocs. It would be like, we're the first ones to do it in Crocs. And it's been quite difficult to find a day on that. So the idea kind of expanded into just, can we do cool sporting stuff in Crocs? So we just, currently we just go play golf in Crocs, it's all we've done at the moment. But, you know, we're trying to build that out into, I don't know what, maybe do a marathon in Crocs, do an Ironman in Crocs. I've got an old pair, which we tried to screw some cycling cleats into. But it's a bad note for Crocsing. The rubber didn't hold, so it doesn't work. But I thought that would be quite funny.
That's class. If you can, I feel like that could go big. Like, that would be good content to get out there.
You got some good content. Check it out.
If you do what Hardest Geezy, Hardest Geezer.
Yeah, yeah.
You did what he did in Crocs, you'd be undefeated.
What he did is crazy.
I don't think you'd be able to walk for the rest of your life if you did that, though. No, that amount of distance.
What, and you have him in sport mode, I'm assuming, as well?
not when we play golf. That's not, you know, it's not high octane enough for the sport mode.
Right, so I guess if we go, like, back, so growing up, what was your, like, family situation like with sport? Like, what were your parents or families kind of outlooks on you doing sport? Like, did they like push you into doing it, or was it kind of you did it at school a bit and then carried on a bit later?
Yeah, sure, I can go. I think like my sort of family situation was very much in the sense of my parents always supported any like sporting endeavor that I wanted to do. I played a lot of different random sports when I was a kid, just as I think most people do, especially in sort of areas where we grow up. So I grew up in South Yorkshire. I feel that's quite similar to where Joel and yourself grew up, Shay. It was just a case of doing football, tennis, rugby, all the rest of it. But I wouldn't say that my family were particularly sporty themselves. It was more a case of that I always, and my brother particularly as well, always expressed interest in doing random sports, and our parents just kind of went, all right, yeah, if you want to do that, that's great, and we'll take you. So they were super, super supportive with that, but it was never a situation of them kind of pushing us into a certain sport or kind of level of competitiveness of sport, as I know like some parents do. You know, if you look at like, I don't know, Formula One drivers or sports where they need to be basically doing it from when they're like 3 or 4 years old, and if that's the only way of becoming the best, it was very much not that situation. So I guess with that, it was just a case of it was just fun to begin with, and it was never really performance focused because of, I guess, that lack of like external pressure, which I think was probably a really nice way to get into sport, to be honest, because then you learn to kind of enjoy it first and then let the kind of I guess, more performance aspect come later. But that being said, I do think I'm quite a competitive person, so it kind of came in quite quickly. And yeah, I think there's sort of everything else sort of spiraled out from there. So I'd say that was what it was like really when I was younger. What about you, Albie?
Yeah, my dad, he is a sensei. I don't know, it's kind of niche terminology, but he basically runs a jiu-jitsu dojo, gym, whatever you want to call it. And he's basically always done that throughout my whole life. So there was always that sport going on. But I guess my like rebellion was to, you know, not do any of that sport and do completely opposite. So, you know, running, rowing, cricket, like tennis, anything with a ball I loved. And then later on it became rowing and cycling and running and that kind of thing. So very much not MMA, but my brother is incredible at MMA. He is, shout out to him, he's like doing it. He now coaches pretty much, well, maybe not full time, he coaches half time now at my dad's dojo and like some other places. So he's just, yeah, he's next level.
How come you've not like got into that? How come you've not want, you didn't want to get into that? Just rebellion, pure rebellion.
Yeah, definitely how it started. Definitely how it started. Maybe I regret it a little bit now because my dad and my brother have this little, you know, bond. They hang out all the time. And then like me and mum will be watching telly and they'll be literally like wrestling each other on the floor. Because my brother will come in like, oh, can I just check this new move I just thought of? And I'm like, guys, we're literally so much telly, can you piss off? But yeah, I mean, I'm too injured to do it now. Honestly, if I did jiu-jitsu, they'd just bend my wrist and I'd be like, sorry.
So is that like a constant thing with your wrist then? It's because first year for you must have been ages ago. So it must have been like a few years that you've had the injury now.
Yeah. It's completely ruined. There's like a... They did like an MRI and the screw is basically stopping the bone moving or something. I wasn't really listening. But yeah, I literally can't move it more than this, even if I try. But, you know, a good story about that is that I was almost on the Paralympic team. I don't know if you know this job.
That is such a you thing to do.
Yeah. Fletch, our rowing coach, he got me involved with this guy, Rob something, who is basically this... like Paralympic talent scout for British rowing. And he met me in like Don Regatta and he looked at my wrist and went, yeah, that looks pretty fucked. Sweet. And he was like, come down to T-side and we'll get you tested. And he had this doctor come out and she played with my wrist for about, you know, 20 minutes and then went, yeah, qualify. I'm like, sick. So then I had no idea that it was a serious thing. I just went down because he said, come down. I wasn't wearing sports kit. And he was like, right, let's get on the rowing machine. I was like, I don't have any kit. So he was like, oh, you can just borrow a uni. So I went and borrowed a uni and then came back in. And we started doing 4x750 meter, I think it was. Because it's like quite a good 2K predictor without actually doing a 2K. Which I was not prepared for at all, but he was just like, yeah, just get a baseline score down. I was like, yeah, chill, whatever. I was literally halfway through it, and the doctor comes running out, like, oh, I read it wrong. And it basically needed like 13 points to qualify for PL1, and I got 12. So Rob was like, all right, you can get me. And he said, if you fuck it up anymore, give us a call.
Let's home in on the hard ergs a little bit more.
Yeah.
Because we've all been through the ringer. I mean, all four of us. And there's an erg room. I don't know if it's a famous erg room at Durham, where we've spent many a days in there, hours at a time, sweating it out, people being sick in buckets. Like, what was your experience with that? What was your favorite session like you took away from that? Because how many ergs was there in there? Like 30 ergs or something?
Probably about that, yeah.
And I had the quotes up above, didn't I?
Yeah, to be honest, if you talk about things that you take away from it, that honestly, those were like some of the biggest things. Because as you've just described, basically an erg room with, you know, rows and about three rows of rowing machines, and you're all facing the same way and you're facing sort of a big wall of quotes. And some of them are quite cringe. They're kind of like the sooner or later the rower that wins is the one that thinks they can and stuff like that. And you know, it's all a bit like when you come in first year, you think, oh god, what's this about? But I guess it's just kind of a war of attrition in that case. It just, you sort of get whittled down after a few years and you start looking at them going, yeah, you know, I guess, you know, that does make sense. And you kind of look at it. So yeah, genuinely, that like a few of the biggest takeaways would have been a couple of the quotes on the wall. I guess we can go into that maybe in a minute. But if you're talking about ergs and hardest ergs or favorite sessions, I mean, there's probably too many to count. I think one of the ones that we did at Durham that I always remember, and I feel like it was fairly unique, was basically you do a 5K. So it's basically a kind of a 5K test sort of prep session. So you do one 5K, I think it was usually about like rate 24, rate 26. So kind of, you know, sort of 75 kind of percent level of rate or at least effort. But our coach was always like, you know, go for it, you know, don't hold back. So you do that one, you're pretty cooked, you have 20 minutes rest, and then you do another 5K. And basically that one is basically you should be PBing on that 5K, which is pretty brutal having just done the first one where they kind of want you to go pretty hard. And 20 minutes rest sounds like a long time until you're there and you're kind of already cooked from the first 5K. You're like walking around the erg room doing like weird pacing strategy, trying to make your legs feel semi-normal again. And yeah, it's just a bit weird. I think that was kind of a very specific session that I haven't really heard many other places do. But I think it was just a really good one because it was kind of a bit of a psychological warfare, because you're kind of in your own head for those 20 minutes in the middle of the rest thinking, oh god, this is gonna absolutely kill this next one. And I think that kind of time, it's almost similar to like when you know, if you're a prisoner of war or something like that and they've captured you, they just leave you in a room and they just think, oh god, when is he gonna come and get me? And the weight is kind of one of the worst parts of it. At least I thought always that was like that weight was just horrible. And yeah, then it was just a good test of like grit, essentially, of how hard you're willing to go on the first one, knowing that you've still got a really long second piece as well, or how deep you're willing to go. So I think the 5K is a pretty nasty distance for most people. So yeah, I'll always remember that one. I'd say.
Yeah, I think the thing is with 5Ks, I only ever did like three or four of them, but I just found them so boring because it's like three and a half K where you're just on the same pace for the whole time. And it's only in that last like two K where you're actually sort of ramping it up. So it's just trying not to get bored for the first like 10 minutes was the main issue. But that was all right. But yeah, that session does sound pretty good because we don't really do anything that long or hard. Well, like when I was at Brooks or anything like that. So we didn't really do longer sessions like that. So it's interesting to hear what sort of sessions we did.
Yeah. Joey, on that, a bit of a topic of debate I always have. Being sick after an erg, right? Is it a mental thing? Like once you do it once, right? Or you force yourself to do it once, you do it every single time, do you think? Or is it something that's genuinely like people just have that other people don't? Because I never felt or was sick after any session in swimming, in rowing, never sick once. And I feel like I pushed myself to the point where like I couldn't stand up or... But some people, even like a mediocre like session, they would still be sick after it. And you know what I'm talking about.
I do.
But yeah. That, what's your opinion on that? Because we debate that quite a lot. Like in swimming, you can't be sick, really, because you're in a pool. Mm. So I feel like we did some horrible session, Shay, swimming when we were young, and almost harder than a lot of the rowing sessions. No one was ever sick. But as soon as you got a bucket next to you,
yeah,
it's almost an invitation to be sick.
I think sometimes when we were swimming, not mentioning any names because I honestly can't really remember who it was, but sometimes I thought people were sometimes putting it on a little bit. You know, when it was like halfway through a session, it was getting a bit hard. They were like, you're not, you're fine. But I think I've never been sick either. And I'm pretty sure it's just something to do with how like people's bodies react to lactate or something like that. But again, I've never had it. I don't know if either of you two have had it.
Joey,
Yeah, I agree with what both of you guys have said. I think like there is an element where it's kind of performative sometimes. You know, you do see those people that are like, oh, I'm going to go again, you know. And once you've done it once, to be fair, it's like it's a bit of a nuclear button that you can just press at any time if you've got that sort of trait. But I genuinely do think it's just down to the individual. So when I was at school, I didn't row for my school, but I rowed for the local club that was near my house. And we had a really, really small squad. It was basically just me and about three others usually when we were first doing it. And then in my final year, it was just me and one other. So we just did a double. And we would basically train every day together. And just it was just the two of us doing ergs and stuff. And we pushed each other pretty hard. We pushed ourselves pretty hard. And my mate, George, who was my doubles partner at the time, without fail, every single hard erg and also every single race was sick. And I don't believe for 1 minute that was performative. You know, it was just a gene that he had that just made that happen. Whereas me, on the other hand, I like to think I pushed myself pretty hard. And at that point, I'd never been sick. I think at Durham, I was sick maybe twice due to ergs. And neither of them, I can say hand on heart, I wasn't faking it. I think it was probably just a case of like something I'd eaten or probably hadn't been recovering right, rather than like I pushed myself to a crazy limit, because I'd probably pushed myself harder on some other places. But I even remember with George, my mate, he would be sick like after every race, even when we were in a boat. So it would make it really awkward when you do like a, if you've ever done it, it's usually more common in like smaller regattas, like Durham Regatta, for example, Albie, which you'll know, where you'll like do a race, you'll do like a heat, and then you have to either like get in and you've got 20 minutes to go again, or you basically have to row back up to the start and do the semi-final or the final or whatever. So I remember one time we were like in our double, just won the heat, and then we turned around and my mate was literally hanging out the side of the boat, like throwing up as our opposition for the semi-final was like rowing past. I was thinking, oh no, but we did beat him anyway, so maybe it sucked him out. But I think it's just completely down to the individual, how they react to the stimulus, basically, because I didn't really affect me, even though I thought I pushed myself fairly hard.
Yeah, it's funny because I actually didn't find those sessions hard, but I actually found, again, you guys had a laugh about this. I actually found that, you know, the 16Ks, I found them the hardest because I didn't see the point of them. I was like,
because you would only ever breathe like, through your nose.
Yeah, I was like, it's my favorite races are the 2Ks, and I felt like I was the fastest on the erg in the squad for 2Ks, and I was like 16K, an hour and a half sat on an erg that's not going anywhere, in a room with people playing music that you don't vibe with that much.
Well, it taking you an hour and a half to do 16K probably explains it, Jeff.
Yeah, it's because he taking pauses halfway to just go and complain while we were doing it.
Hour and 15. But, you know, mentally, those sessions were actually really hard, I thought. And it takes you like 30, 40 minutes into it until you like get into a state of like flow, I thought. The first 20 minutes of that 16Ks, which rowers do basically every day to build their aerobic base. And of course, I know it is what you have to do. But at the time, I just found that way harder than the other sessions. Because the other sessions, at least it's like competitive. You're trying to beat people. But those sessions, it's like where there's no fun. I didn't find them fun at all.
I think it's...
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, I think it's because of the... Obviously, we started with swimming. And the longest intervals you do in swimming is like, what, 800s? Maybe if you're doing like a longer, steadier session, and they'll take about 10, 12 minutes or something like that. You're never going to do something. You're never going to swim for an hour straight. So it just, like, compared to swimming, it just feels so boring because you're so used to doing short, fast intervals and stuff like that and just racing people all the time. But yeah, it sounds like you weren't training in the right zones, Joel. That's what it sounds like, actually, I think.
Yeah, maybe that was it. Yeah, but Olby, give us your favourite sessions or what you enjoyed about rowing times.
Yeah. Honestly, I was thinking about this when you invited me to the podcast. Thinking like, what part of rowing do I maybe miss the most? And to be honest with you, obviously the racing I miss and all that kind of stuff, but that what generally what I miss most is Tuesday evening ergs. Like everybody, you know, you have way too much caffeine. You spend the whole day worrying about it. You have a nap. You leave uni at midday to go have a nap before because you've worked. You had like only 3 hours of sleep last night because you were up on your phone playing Reels all day. Go home, have a nap, get a load of scrying, head down before you watch the wave before you with your monster in your hand, chop it, buzzing, and then you just go. And it's got to be a 30 rate 20. Those are the best days, man. I love a 30 rate 20. It's the only erg I will do now is a 30 rate 20.
Yeah, 30 rate 20s were horrific. For the listeners, 30 rate 20.
You had a bit of a naughty 30 rate 20, didn't you? Joel, I thought...
I did have a naughty 30 rate 20, I have to say. I can't remember what it was, but it was definitely gas.
43?
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah, it was something like that. But those ones are good because everyone's at the same rate. So like,
yeah,
it is just awesome. Funny when you can compare yourself like directly and everyone finishes at the same time. It's not like who finishes first. But yeah, no, those sessions were really hard. And the fact that you knew what the session was going to be a week in advance, just you were just dwelling on it all week. You're trying to do your uni work. You're in lectures. You're going to sleep. You're waking up, you know, all the time. You're thinking about these ergs. But if you could both like pinpoint as you're both kind of in the city, you know, you've had good jobs. What is a skill that you've learned from rowing that you're now kind of using in day to day life that you think that's been the most valuable?
I genuinely think there's so many. It's really hard to boil it down to one or two. I think like two that I can think of straight away. The sort of main thing is just that your sort of general outlook to kind of work and life. And I think, you know, rowing kind of teaches you lessons in discipline and persistence and kind of wanting to basically work hard for whatever outcome that you're seeking. So, I do often see like a difference between people that have like had a similar experience either in rowing or a similar sort of maybe an endurance sport or kind of whatever it might be, in the way that they sort of, you know, carry themselves and they work and they're sort of disciplined. But I would say like two that definitely spring to mind for me. The first is kind of accountability. I think when you're rowing, you're obviously usually in a crew boat and there's eight of you or four of you or whatever. And you're very much held accountable by the other seven or whatever members of that crew to basically pull your weight and make sure that you're not going to bail on them, especially in the very important moments. And I always remember we had a rowing coach who's maybe a bit of a controversial figure these days, and who sort of left the club in slightly dubious circumstances. But he did come out with a couple of like good quotes and good sort of isms that you can take. I always remember he said like, he said it actually to one of our crewmates who was a bit of a funny guy, and he always tried to lean on the coach and stuff like this. But he was like, if you say you're going to do something, do it. Otherwise, don't say it. And I always that's literally burned into my brain, because I think in work, it's so important to have that accountability. You know, if you say to someone, oh, I'm going to get this to your desk by Tuesday morning, or yeah, I can help with that project because I've got the time or whatnot, or I'm going to, you know, do this certain level of outcome. Then if you don't then deliver on what you've said you're going to do, it's kind of like irreparable, that sort of like, I don't know, sort of mental shift that person will then have in their mind of their perception of you, because they've given you a sort of set thing and you've not held your word accountable essentially to what you're going to do. So essentially a way to avoid that is if you know that you're not going to be able to do that, just don't even say it in the first place. I think that holds like a really good sort of, I don't know, level of accountability for yourself to kind of make sure the task that you're taking on, you really commit to doing, and then you don't oversell yourself and then risk the kind of potential reputational downfall of that. I think the other one is kind of like the kind of like polarization of your time. So I see a lot of people at work that kind of just sort of And this is going to sound maybe a little bit harsh. They kind of sort of meander along with sort of like a steady workload. They'll kind of do, you know, a similar route of work for all of the time that they're on their sort of project or they're on their task or whatever. You know, they'll never really increase that level of workload, but they'll also never really decrease it. And me personally, and I think this is a way that a lot of ex-rowers and ex-athletes are wired, would much rather give a really intense period of effort towards a certain task, see it through to completion and kind of make sure it's the best that they could possibly do, and then like really enjoy the rest period after that, even if it's only short, just to make sure that you've kind of like polarized your effort for when it's needed and then when it's not needed. And also I see a lot of people kind of putting in that same level of effort even when, you know, it's not necessary or no one's asking them for it. Whereas I feel like kind of rowers and athletes are able to kind of have that sort of polarized scale. So I'd say those are, for me, like the two main things.
Yeah, it's funny because a guy we know, I was talking to him recently about kind of how valuable sport is when you go into work. And one of the things we spoke about is having a different friendship group to the people at work. Because we were talking about at work, there's so many, for example, on a Thursday night, which tends to be like the night out in London, that people tend to either go out with work colleagues or friends in the city rather than in like their bubble of Clapham or wherever that you would go out on a Saturday night. But some people who don't have that sports background, or especially in a team sport, I've noticed, tend to always go out with people from work. For example, on a Thursday night, a Saturday night. And I found it so valuable to be able to completely step away from work on a Thursday night and on a Saturday night, just because I've got multiple friendship groups from sport that obviously aren't in work and are more friends than like acquaintances. You know, you could trust them, and it's like it's just a different atmosphere. I don't know if you guys have had the same, but I've 100% experienced that.
Yeah, I also think to what you said, Joe, I guess it kind of touches on the accountability thing, but like literally the main lesson that I learned through sport is that you're not going to get anything that you want without working hard at it. And kind of, nothing's going to get given to you, basically. You're going to have to work your way to wherever you want to be. So that's literally like the accountability point that you brought is that basically the main lesson that I've learned through sport.
Yeah, what about you, Ollie?
Yeah, I think Joey covered it pretty well. I work in a very different company to I think probably all three of you. So I work at a startup. So there's only five of us, six of us, and then myself. It's a very, very small company. So it's a very different dynamic. It's kind of the periodization you talk about, Joey, is just inherent in what projects we've got going on, and you know. It's so different every day. It's not consistent at all, which I actually really enjoy. I think one of the things that it has maybe taught me rowing is like kind of, I think the main thing about rowing is you have to trust your teammates. I think that's kind of the like main thing is that you've got to trust that they're going to pull as hard as they can. Dan Armstrong loves to call it like, everybody's going to, in this club's going to die for each other, whatever. It's a bit wet, but that kind of like trust that you are actually going to all pull together on this. You don't get in a lot of other sports, so I think that's like a really good point for rowing, and probably something that you've learned is I'm very happy to trust people that they're also going to put the work in. I don't have to do it all myself.
Yeah, in a startup, because let's just home in on that a little bit more. Everything's surely amplified, right? So I heard recently, I think I saw a video on it. It was like in a big company, you can almost hide, right? You can almost, like you say, Joey, just meander along, do the bare minimum, collect your paycheck and leave. Whereas in a startup, you're judged on your output. Like there's no hiding. Like the company relies on you and people are going to see how much work you're doing. And I think it relates so much to what you said, Joey, about accountability. Surely everything's just completely amplified and you're out in the open and you do have to just work so hard to get the company off the ground. Because at the end of the day, someone's like dedicated their life to starting that company, and they've picked you because they believe, you know, you've got that drive within you, which I know you do.
Yeah, it's a great point. I think, to be honest, my boss, Namid, he does a very good job of kind of, because he knows that me and my co-worker, Andrea, were still quite young. So, and the company has enough, like, people who are very experienced and know what they're doing and know a lot better than us, that we're kind of still very much in the kind of learning phase. And he's doing a very good job of shielding us from working way too much, put it that way. So the company's got very good kind of work ethic in that we have projects that we need to do, and sure, that sometimes that might mean you have to work a little bit late, but it's never crazy. And when you're taking holiday, you're actually taking proper holiday. And I think that's all down to the kind of culture of the company, which is, I guess, quite similar to sport, which is where when you're on, but when you're off, you're very much off. And I think that's kind of very important.
Yeah, I bet you have to be so careful with burnout in a startup, especially. Because it's a smaller team, one person burning out, it can have like a crippling effect.
Yeah.
If that person is like especially higher up.
And the capability of you to just kind of, so the startup that I work is basically coding, and I know what needs to be done, and I could just sit there and code it all in like 3 or 4 days if I work nonstop. But then, you know, I'm not going to work for like 2 weeks straight because I'm going to be like, oh, I've done it all. Then run out of things to do or not be motivated to then just keep going. And it's actually better to obviously keep that kind of consistent workflow, work output. And then also, you don't want to do it all yourself. You have to make sure you're collaborating and making sure that everybody else is kind of inputting with their ideas and understand what you're doing. So it's, yeah, exactly. It's a good thing to kind of keep moderation.
Yeah. So I'm assuming neither of you are rowing anymore. What are you doing with your spare time nowadays?
Yeah, not rowing. I think after 4 years of uni, I was pretty ready to stop that, to be honest. I remember like in the final year, I would like wake up for a morning session on the weekends, and I would like literally be counting down like, okay, only 50 more of these to go, pretty much. So yeah, I was pretty done with it. But no, I think like it didn't take long before I was kind of ready for the next challenge or thing to kind of keep me busy and keep that sort of discipline that I think helps your other areas in life that kind of rowing provided. Gives you a lot of structure and a lot of kind of, as we've talked about, accountability. And, you know, if you've got, you know, you've got a session in the morning, you better get it done so then you can go and do your work and whatnot. So, yeah, I was definitely looking for something like that and basically started, and I think Ollie's now doing a similar thing. Started picking up triathlon a little bit, and in June did my first ever half Ironman, which was a really cool experience and really actually enjoyed the training leading up to that. Was quite lucky that was able to do it with a few mates and actually a few ex-rowers who we all rowed together at Durham. So I guess that's another sort of plus from the rowing aspect, is that you have sort of like-minded friends that are willing to do those kind of challenges with you, and willing to push you and keep you accountable. Because I think probably without those people, and one or two in particular who are really invested in it, I definitely wouldn't have trained as hard. And we almost created a bit of a sense of competition between ourselves, which gave us a really nice goal to aim for. So yeah, just did that, and in doing that, kind of discovered or managed to try, and Joel's going to laugh at me at this, but managed to try and develop a new skill, which is swimming, which I never really did that much. So when I was a kid, I kind of just did my, whatever you call them, like barracuda or whatever badges. You can stay afloat, you can swim 50 meters. Then I was back off to the football pitch pretty much. So learning to like swim freestyle properly as an adult was a very humbling experience, especially when I sort of realized that all of my mates from rowing somehow were sort of absolute prodigies in swimming in their childhood, you know, Joel and a few of the others that we're friends with. So they were always laughing at me, but they was also really helpful in kind of giving me, you know, tips, because I basically approached it as if I were, you know, a rower or a runner. I was like, right, I'll just do as much of it as I can. I'll just keep going and going, and surely I'll get better. And it turns out swimming's not quite like that. I ended up kind of having to sort of basically teach myself the technique of swimming. My YouTube and Instagram algorithm changed quite a lot, let's just say that. But yeah, it was really good fun, and it was a really cool experience at the end. Like culminating it all with the half Ironman, which we did in Switzerland. So just cool to explore a new place and take on a new challenge, which was really rewarding.
Yeah, and I was going to ask both of you, because I was going to ask both of you how the swimming was, because from all of the people that I know that have gone from rowing to do triathlon, they've all found the swimming so hard. Because it's such a technique-based sport that if you don't do it from young, like Joel and I did, it can be so hard to learn as you get older. So, like, how often did you train for the swimming, and kind of how long did it take for you to learn it?
Ollie, do you want to take that one, or should I?
My half Ironman that I'm doing, kind of inspired by Joe, is in 26 days. And I've had about a month ago, I dislocated my shoulder. So if I'm honest, the swimming aspect of the Ironman has been very much to the side. It's getting better. I've got like Joey, I've got a mate, James, who's an incredible swimmer, and he's been giving me tips in the pool. But his tips are mostly your legs are sinking, and he's like, I can't remember how to fix that, and I'm like, sick. Let's just hope a wetsuit fixes that, I guess. I need to do some open water stuff. I think that's the key. I'm kind of okay in the pool, but I get really, it's just boring as hell. At least when you're rowing in a rowing machine or running, you can listen to music or a podcast. I guess there are headphones that you can listen to in the pool, but I feel like that's blasphemy. That's like wearing gloves in the gym.
It's swimming's a hard one, right? Because I found, especially starting as like a beginner rower, that if you get too much advice, it can hinder you more. I made my biggest like leaps and bounds when someone would just tell me one thing, and I had like three whole like sessions on the time, like 2 hour sessions, just thinking about that one thing. And I remember when you first went, Joey, I can't lie, you came on so much, but that first session, I was worried for you. you were struggling, but by the end, you just looked like a good swimmer. Like, but I remember thinking at the start, I was just like trying to give you so much different bits of advice. But I remembered what I was like starting your sport of rowing. I was actually one thing at a time. Let's just slowly build it up. And I guess that's what James has been like with you, Ollie, as well. I found that is a much better way to develop.
Also, like, less help sometimes is better because it forces you to think about it. Like, you maybe need someone to tell you what they can visually see is wrong with you. So, like, you know, in rowing, there might be you're leaning the wrong way. And then it's quite helpful to actually, if you get that kind of feedback from a coach being like, oh, you're still leaning the wrong way. Yeah, you're still leaning the wrong way. And then you can kind of work out the mechanics of what you need to do to fix it. That gives you an overall better feel of what you're doing, as opposed to just kind of, just like being told exactly how to fix it and do it, like not learning. I don't know. If that makes sense.
No, that does make sense. I mean, when I first learned to row, I would just put out in a single in St. Andrews, basically. And the coach was just like, just go out and row. I'm not even going to tell you anything. You're just going to row up and down until you figure it out. Yeah. And it took me like 6 months, but eventually you figure it out just through like whatever feels best. And you've got the speed coach, and you just figure out whatever's making it go fastest. And I think it's the same with swimming. It's like the general feel of the water and how to move your body through it and everything like that. It's just general experience makes it so much easier.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And what Joel was saying, I think like you can be told something loads and loads of times, and it, you know, maybe sometimes it will sink in, but I feel like you only really learn something. This is probably true of like basically anything. You only really learn something when you're the one to like figure it out yourself. And as you say, like you swim in a certain way and you like feel the difference in speed, or you can see the difference in speed. And then it goes like it finally twigs because you've done it, not because someone else has told you. And to be fair, like this is a conversation that we had in Durham. I remember, I think this is probably the case of being a mediocre athlete. You're kind of, when you're at the sort of middle or bottom of the squad, what happens is you usually get like a sort of an eclectic mix of people. I feel like at the top of the squad, you get the people who are both sort of very good physically and also motivated. Whereas I feel like in the middle of the bottom of the squad, you get like people who are really motivated but aren't very good physically, or kind of vice versa. or people who are really good technically but not physically, or vice versa. So you kind of like, you're dealing with a lot of different kind of attitudes and sort of levels of commitment and also physiology. So one of the things we always like struggled with was trying to get people to like buy into like just the training and, you know, wanting to work hard for each other or wanting to commit to certain technical changes and whatnot. I remember kind of like with a few other people sort of banging our heads against the wall, trying to get some people to change their technique or to keep turning up to the sessions and trying hard and whatnot. And we kind of realized that ultimately you can tell people as much as they want, as much as you want, like to do a certain thing, but really they're only going to make a change when it's their own kind of like inner sort of like understanding that they make the change themselves. So I guess in that way, like you kind of just have to lead into it, or you can kind of get a bit clever and do like a little inception sort of vibe where you kind of, you plant an idea and then make them think it was their idea to change it or whatnot. I think that's that, but it's similar to the swimming thing. You kind of only really understand it when you do it yourself rather than someone telling you.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of our coach, our last coach that you touched on a bit before. And he was very much let everyone do their own thing. Just get out on the water, don't say a word, and just let each other almost coach each other. Like, you put some good people at the front of the boat. You're a wizard at the front. Like, and you let the people that, you know, have a bit of power but no technique or whatever, sit in the middle, shielded, you know. And you eventually start to move with the people at the front. And before you know it, you're in line with them. But I had a question for you both. And it's, what was your favorite memory as a rower at Durham? It can be anything, social, whatever.
I think I've got two. One's like an actual rowing one, and then one's just a kind of random one. I think the rowing one was in my fourth year of uni. So kind of been, as you talked about, Joel, been going on for quite a while in the rowing squad and sort of like gradually made it up and up. I sort of started towards the bottom of the squad, made my way towards basically the top of the second eight, and sort of managed to compete at a few Henleys and win a few box medals along the way. And then in my fourth year of uni, I was in the stroke seat of the second eight, and we did Met Regatta, which is basically one of the races kind of leading up to Henley. That's quite a kind of important sort of pre-race for that. And it's at Dorney Lake where the 2012 Olympic was. So it's a really cool like multi-lane race basically. And we won like the academic eights. So it's basically like student eights on one of the days. And we were in like the A final, so we basically did the time trial. And I think there was potentially some dubious circumstances with the weather, as the first eight like to say, but we basically were 0.1 seconds off the first eight on the time trial. So that in itself was like a really vindicating result to be that close. But then we winning the race was like a really cool experience because it was just like a proper sort of validation of all the hard work you've done up to that point, and then sort of winning in a bit of style was really, really fun. So I'd say that was a good one. And then as a bit of like just the other random one, it's not one specific time, but I just remember us all in the erg room that we talked about before, kind of lined up doing the 16Ks that Joel didn't like, and we always had music on speakers, and usually towards the summer, whilst everyone in the squad kind of knows each other quite well, it's starting to get like a bit of better vibes because it's, you know, the weather's getting better and you're kind of down to shorter races and stuff. I remember just people like putting music on and everyone just like screaming along to the words of any given song. Like you had all your like classic like white girl music, like your Katy Perry's and stuff like that, and just all these various different songs, and everyone was just singing all the words. And it was just a really like, I don't know, it's a really fun memory of a time where like everyone was so bonded with like everything that we were doing, and we were just enjoying ourselves and having a bit of a laugh. Like that's a really strong memory for me, I'd say.
Yeah, class. Summer in. I remember in winter in the bleak of winter, right? Everyone used to say, I was like, oh, when you got icicles off the side of the boat or whatever. Like, why am I doing this? Like, why am I going to the Tyne for half the day? Muddy, horrible, But I know you used to say, Joey, you know, it'll be worth it in the summer. It'll be worth it in the summer. And when it gets round to summer, it is actually quite worth it if you qualify for M. But it is.
True.
It is worth it. Like, your summer is just so nice. When you get your blazer on, everyone's just sipping Pimm's.
Yeah, that's not
the
rowing. Yeah, rows. So nothing to do with the actual rowing.
Yeah.
Not doing the winter job.
But yeah, summer is just so but much better than winter.
The ergon is also awful because it's like snowing in Durham. And then we don't have any heating in there, so we just open all the doors, so it's freezing. It's like negative degree. And then it takes you about 40 minutes of your 16K to actually get to a point where you're warm enough to have a heart rate, which is decent. Your heart rate sits at like 90 for the first half. It takes ages to warm up. So it's just the worst.
What about yourself, Olby? What's your favourite memory?
There's one session where the third eight gelled. First time ever. Some serious stuff. Mano on the speakers popping down some serious lines. And the first day were having a mare day. They were having this, like, I don't know what it was doing. They were just having a bad one. And we were rowing up against the stream up, and we were just basically on them the whole session. I mean, we were cooked. They were probably chilling. But they were getting really, really pissed off. And I really enjoyed pissing them off. That was fun. It even maybe not so good for squad morale, but for R8, it was very good. That one is, you know, it's always fun being an underdog and kind of pissing people off. And I'd say that time, and then also when we're training for Head of the River, and you had Mano pissing off, pissing everybody off basically with his line, because he's from Westminster, so he knew the line and the tideway better than all the other coxes, maybe apart from Oscar. And yeah, he would just do a better line, and poor Casper in the second, they would really struggle. And it's quite funny. So that was good. Yeah,
I remember it's so competitive between all the boats. And I remember there's a legendary boat in my second year.
Yes.
Where everyone was so competitive. And now I look back at that boat and I think, you know, there were some ex-GB rowers in that boat. And it was, you know, the third eight. And I'll never forget when we came out of that head race and someone shouted from the bank, "Yeah, you came first, you came first." And the second eight were like, What? How on earth are they beating us? But that was great. Just the competitivity and then being able to come on top. Again, no good for the squad morale, was it really? But great for your morale.
Yeah. I was timing that result because it was when I was injured and I was helping out do the timing for the head race. Other Joel texted me and he was like, "Did we actually win? You didn't doctor the results, we actually won." I was like, yeah. I wasn't the only one timing. There's like eight of us timing. It's a fair result. He was like so adamant that we got it wrong.
Yeah, my shoe was on the other foot for that because I was in the other boat, the second eight, who was supposed to be like the boat ranked above. And we came like fifth or something. So we really clearly have fucked it. And they'd obviously beaten us as the third eight. And honestly, heads were gone at that point. There was all sorts going around. There was a few people like, "They've got it wrong, you know, we need to go and challenge it," or something like that. And then there was a few people like heads in hands and just, it was like someone had, you know, chucked a grenade and just sort of left it in there. And so squad morale maybe wasn't the best that day, but I can appreciate for you guys how awesome that would have been and like vindicated to turn over the result, you know.
It's just funny because in that third eight, and I'm sure it's the same in most like bottom eights in most uni squads, there's such a range of characters in there that it makes it even better. Like in ours, we had people that caught crabs on a regular. Catching crabs for the listeners is where you get you basically pull the oar and it gets stuck underwater. And basically, sometimes you have a boat stopper where the whole boat will stop because you get it stuck in the water and you can't get it out and it almost cuts you in half, you know. And then we had one guy that was like first in the year for law. Another guy that, you know, retook uni like two times or whatever. Like such a range of characters in there. And to pull through, I found that having a range of characters and doing that made you gel so much together. And then you're just like, yeah, these lads are just incredible guys, you know. And like I said about the mates thing, like now I live with Rose, I live with Joey. And you would just never get that in many other sports, to be honest. But rowing, because you're all in that boat, stuck together, you know, you can't get anywhere. You have to turn up to the session, otherwise your eight can't row because they need eight people. So yeah, that camaraderie was something that they'll just never go away.
What I found really funny about UD Sport, and like, obviously when you're at Brooks, because there's so much chat between eights all the time, it's like people get so rattled and people care so much. But then you realise, like, when you stop rowing, you look back and you're like, why did I care so much at that point about that thing? It's like you leave and you're like, the only thing that really matters is how much fun you had and the friends you made. Like, all of the results and stuff, like, genuinely just don't really matter that much, at least to me anyway. I don't know how you two feel about that.
I completely agree. And it may be biased from someone who didn't exactly do insane things in the sport of rowing. But I've had this confirmed from multiple people who have been very successful in the sport, you know, like people who have won Henley, just saying, like, you won't remember finishing a bit further ahead in that one race or how many medals you got, but you will remember, like, the laughs you had with mates and really, like, whether those people, like, are still your mates in 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And I think the fact of kind of how we all sort of gel together, as Joel was just touching on, in those boats, really does mean that that's something that is a reality and is hopefully going to be the case for that amount of time. And so for me, yeah, I agree, that's way more valuable than the results that we would have got.
Yeah. Touching on that and mates and who you meet while you're rowing, give me, without naming any names, number one character that you met while rowing. Character. Could be a coach, could be someone that you rowed with. Number one character, because mine was, I would say, a guy that in the squad was just like the center of every social thing. Only a little guy sat at the back of the boat and was just hilarious. Like, you'd just be rowing along and then he would just do a little, like a little shaggy, like, little thing. And he'd just boost the morale, like, massively. You know, having those characters. But any characters that spring to mind?
I would say our coach. I don't think, honestly, I don't think anything could have brought us all together like that. I mean, the number of impressions that we all do of him is, like, off the charts. You know, there is something to be said about a coach is a bit of a Terence Fletcher and Whiplash character, you know, kind of number one, bringing kind of your, like, you're kind of fueled by maybe a little bit of hatred. Yeah, maybe a little bit. But, like, it does bring everyone together quite a lot, I think. So I would actually say him.
Yeah, I think I probably agree with you, Obi, to be honest. It's like, weirdly, having that kind of antagonist that you can almost bond about because you've all got a shared, you know, or at least most people got a shared, like, experience of that person. And you've all been kind of subject to whatever, like, session or whatever treatment he's got for you together, really, like, forces you to kind of bond yourself together. And I always, like, it kind of always got you questioning, like, as you made the sort of Whiplash analogy, like, it was crazy the amount of debates we had about, like, oh my God, this guy's a bona fide genius. You know, he wants you to think that you're dropped because he knows that he's actually going to put you in the top eight. Or then the next week he's like, no, he's just an idiot. You know, he just actually has no idea what he's doing. And I don't know. I think I actually don't know. I change every day. I wake up on a different side of the world. Yeah.
It's two words more harmful to human success than good job.
Good job. Yeah.
Definitely true. Yeah.
So I think that, yeah, just that experience, like, sort of made it, didn't it, really?
Yeah. Talking about characters, Shay, Brooks must have had a couple characters in there.
Many characters, mate. Many characters. I mean, they're obviously, like, I don't know if you have the same at Durham, but there are some people at Brooks that have been there for years and will be there for years and like will never leave. They just love rowing so much and they love the program so much. But then there are just ultimate characters in that they just take the piss and just piss about. But I think at least when I was there, the main, like the coach that was there last year was like, he was a big character because he had like so much influence over the athletes. But yet, even if people got dropped or whatever, people like believed in what he was doing and actually trusted what he was doing because they knew from like the decade of results he'd had before that he was going to find out the best way to make the quickest boat. So I think it was more so just like, even if he got dropped, you're pissed off, but you kind of understood why, and everyone had an understanding of what they actually needed to do to move that way. With Brooks, it used to be fully run by the coaches, and there was no student committee or anything like that. I'm assuming Durham was student committee with a president, captains, and everything like that, which I think made it a lot easier for Brooks because there weren't all of the approvals and everything like that that you have to get. The coaches could see what they deemed the best for the athletes and the club at that point and just do it. But I think, I mean, at least when I was at St. Andrews, and I'm assuming it was the same at Durham, having that kind of student-led committee can make it a bit more difficult to get stuff done. Did you, I don't know if any of you were kind of involved in that or had experience with that.
Yeah, I think student-led committees are actually, they're really good because the skills you learn as a student are like invaluable, you know, learning to deal with, I mean, if you're a treasurer, you learn, you especially with rowing, it's, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds because these boats are so expensive. So the skills you can learn from like applicable to jobs are huge and look good on the CV and all that kind of stuff. But actually, I do think they're really tricky because as a student, you're only there for 4 years, 3 years, and you can't see the like bigger picture of the squad. And I think a lot of the time you're kind of limited by that. So a lot of the time you want to leave the club better than how you found it. But in doing so, you might, you know, buy something crazy expensive that looks really great for like 2 years, but actually you needed to save that money and recoup and get something more expensive. And I think that's the same across all university sport, is that when you have these kind of student-led committees, they're not constant enough that they actually work. So I think having a coach meeting is good, but also bad. You know, there's a lot of pros and cons. So yeah, it goes either way.
Yeah, I agree with where you're coming from. And especially with the treasury part, I know some people that did that, and we all will. And taking subs and fees from students is like pulling teeth. You know, it's so hard, and it almost cripples. It can sometimes cripple clubs, like not being able to get that. And at Durham, it was because we didn't have a river that was really rowable for like an eight. You know, we had to travel to the Tyne, which meant we had to get drivers. Students had to drive to the Tyne. There was a minibus, but it wasn't big enough. And even the fees that you would rack up from petrol to taking people, that was almost like expensive in itself. And Shane and I have talked on like the accessibility of sport in previous podcasts. And there is a reason that I feel like certain people struggle to have access to rowing when they're younger, just because how expensive the sport is. And at uni, the cost does ramp up. You got your fees, especially Durham, you got your petrol. But it's not like a gateway, but I always found it was worth it. I worked at a restaurant through my time at Durham as a pot washer, just so I could do rowing, which was, I think, the friends you make and the skills that you learn are just completely invaluable. But yeah, it's an expensive sport, and treasury is a hard role in the squad.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, I mean, if we like going back to Brooks, I think obviously there were loads of things that kind of contributed to their success or whatever. But like kind of coaching quality, equipment, kind of quality of athletes and everything like that. But I do think the structure of coaches being able to run it exactly how they want and not have to answer particularly to a president of the club or men's captain or women's captain didn't mean that they could just get stuff done way quicker, buy the boats they wanted, buy the telemetry, whatever they wanted, and figure out how they were going to do stuff. And it, yeah, I think it, I don't know how it's going to look going forward, but if it does change, it's something that is going to, I guess that's another advantage that they did have that might end up going after there are changes in the way.
It's like if you're the president and you're a student president, you have 1 year to kind of make your impact, but the small impact that you might make might be not efficient because you could have waited 4 years and write out a massive like 7-8 year plan and then have a lot more money to do something. You know, for example, for Durham, it'd be great to buy a boat house down at Tyne because we're basically working out of an air raid shelter, and it would be awesome to have like, I don't know, somewhere warm to sit in between sessions instead of freezing your house off, stuff like that. But that's obviously not going to happen because, you know, not at least not for a while, because we need so much money and it's hard to kind of persuade a president to, instead of buying a nice swanky new boat or telemetry or whatever it might be, you kind of want to make your own impact, then it's quite difficult to say, actually, I'm going to plant a seed for a tree of shade I'll never see, whatever that saying is.
Yeah.
Yeah, agreed.
So we normally end it with a quick fire round of just a few questions to end it off. So the first one I'm going to hit you with is, who's your kind of biggest inspiration in your life? Who's the person that's had the biggest impact on your sporting career, whether it's a coach, a family member, a friend?
I want to say John Boyle. He was our SSE coach at Durham. And there's no one who has a bad word to say about him. He's brilliant. Kind of 90% of the reason I kept rowing at Durham for as long as I did, especially through my injury. Taught me lots about how it can help your body recover and how important it is to keep that kind of longevity with S&C and stretching and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, he will be invaluable for probably my whole life, the lessons that I learned from him.
Yeah, we were thinking, I actually spoke to John Boyle not long ago, and Will Fletcher, the current coach at Durham, an ex-Olympian, and they're up for the podcast. So in the next few months, you know, we're going to get those two on. So the listeners, if you're listening now, then look forward to that one, because he is an absolute legend. Been at the club for so long. He's, you know, he could be, you know, the GB S&C coach, but Durham has got a strong place in his heart. And he genuinely does care about every athlete and want to make the best for you.
And I've heard a lot about him, not even just from you, Joel, like from other people that haven't even been to Durham. I've heard them say like they've got a sick S&C coach. And we just need to get up to Durham and chat to him, I think. And then he can put us through the ringer in that suite.
He definitely could. Yeah. If you got a harder session from John, you would be on the floor.
That sounds good. That would be so fun.
Yeah,
I felt like we never got a hard session from him because he was always trying to just keep us kind of in maintenance mode. You know, when you're doing that much cardio, you kind of just need to keep the body ticking over. You can't afford to stress it too much. But I would love to have a kill your leg session from John. That'd be awesome.
Yeah. Right, Joey, yours.
I would say my first proper coach is called a guy called Dave Rumble. Basically, when I started rowing, it was pootling around up and down the river, just kind of in random singles. There was no sort of direction to it, which I wasn't particularly enjoying, just because I'm not that kind of person. If I'm doing something, I kind of want to do it competitively and sort of thing. So I was probably on the verge of quitting. And then this guy, Dave, came over and he was an ex-rower from university and stuff that was grew up around our area. And he came and took a group of us and kind of put us through the ringer a little bit and basically taught us how to row competitively. And I'd see that as quite a big shift in terms of, you know, my life, because at that point it was very just much a hobby and kind of thing, and I probably would have continued playing football and various other things and might have just kind of meandered through the rest of my school life. And I think given the fact that he sort of pushed us into that
sort of competitive lane and gave us an opportunity to work hard and kind of see the fruits of our labor meant that I then, you know, spent the rest of my time at school basically focusing on rowing and then simultaneously focusing on work and then rowed at university. So there's a pretty big knock-on effect, I'd say, for what I've gone on to do in the future. So yeah, I would say him for sure. Kind of that was a bit of a shift when I was probably about 15 years old.
Yeah. No, it seems very inspirational for your running career. But next question. Let's actually keep this one quickfire. And it is favorite sports team.
Man United.
Maybe it won't count, but the England cricket squad.
Ben Stokes. Currently drawn with India.
Their test against India at the moment is so good.
Yeah, I agree.
Right. I've got another one. Who's the greatest athlete of all time?
Do you know what? I've just finished watching the Tour de France. I'll put a shout in for Tadej Pogacar. Because he is absolutely nuts. I think he's won now 4 Tour de France's. He's like 26 or 27. And he's like, you have everyone else who's sort of quite close to each other fighting out for second spot. And then he's just minutes away from everyone else. He's so much better than all the best other cyclists in the world. So I think him, to be honest.
Yeah.
Usain Bolt. Yeah, I mean, don't really need to say anymore. I mean, 9 gold medals, got one taken away because of one of his team's doping, right? But for us, like, he was starting when we were like 8. 2007 was when we were like 8. So he kind of followed his whole career up until 2020. Awesome bloke. And I love how he like dances on the start line. I mean, it's just so awesome.
I love Usain Bolt. He just does what he wants, man. I respect it. It's so good.
And he doesn't even train. Like, his training was so different to everyone else at the time as well.
He had a Big Mac before his final at Beijing or something like that. It's crazy.
I think it was chicken nuggets.
Yeah, that's it.
So we always finish with the same question because Shane and I will be attempting your hardest sessions. So, what are your hardest sessions? I know you mentioned a couple before, but list them off, quick fire.
My hardest session, I'd say, I think it could be pretty difficult for you to do, was seat racing on the River Tyne. It was basically 6 runs of 1,500 meters, and you split them by about maybe half an hour or something like that. But the kind of kicker was that you didn't know that if you were going to be swapped the next time, and essentially if you were going to be tested against someone else. So you basically just had to go as hard as you could for every single one. And again, it comes down to that kind of like psychological warfare almost. It was just played on your mind so much. So I'd say that. But outside of that, I think probably a weird hard one that we did was 30 seconds on, 10 seconds off. And I think it was times maybe like 20 or something like that. And the 10 seconds off is just zero rest at all, because by the time you've finished it and you start, like, you go back down the slide, you're ready to start the next one. And the directive was go as hard as you can for the 30 seconds. So yeah, that was a bit of a nasty one.
Robin?
I reckon hour of power on the bike. I think that is the most mentally tough thing you can do. I don't understand how some people in the squad could pull the numbers they did as well. That was just crazy. That is tough.
Hour of power, is that just as hard as you can go for a whole hour?
As hard as you can for an hour, yeah.
And what sort of watts would people at Durham be doing for that?
Oh, Metric did over 300, I'm pretty sure. He was like 330 or something ridiculous.
Yeah, class.
He'll tell you what he got. He'll know like that. He's so good with that kind of stuff.
Thank you very much both for coming on the podcast. It'll be exciting to see where you take yourselves in the future with the skills you've learned in rowing. On to the next, maybe see you again on another podcast in the future.
I'd love to be back, yeah. Thank you both.
Yeah, thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. It was interesting to hear both Joey's and Ollie's experience as athletes. If you enjoyed the podcast, please drop us a subscribe and a like to hear more content like this in the future.